changed a few of the details and the names. It was probably a similar type of formation that was used in 119 BC by the Han armies to encircle and destroy one of the forces of the Xuan Nu. The only difference is that the Han general, Wei Jing, had crossbows and chariots. He had some cavalry provided by his steppe nomads. But it would be a similar type of arrangement. Heavy infantry in the center, two advanced flanks of infantry with missile weapons, followed by cavalry attacks out in an enveloping attack. This is the only response that an army from a literate urban civilization can really come up with to gain any kind of tactical advantage fighting nomadic cavalry. And it is a rare number of states from the Romans and the Han Chinese really down to the advent of modern firearms, which is the 16th century. It's a rare number of states that are able to field such armies and to defeat nomadic cavalry in set battles. And as we shall see, the nomadic cavalry have an immense tactical advantage on the battlefield, and bringing them to bay is very, very difficult. And the Manual of Arrian gives us one of our best glimpses into serious efforts to counter the nomadic way of war. Well, what about these three tribes themselves? Besides their importance in illuminating the military relationships between literate civilizations and nomadic peoples, what sort of role did they come to play in the Roman Empire? And what did the Romans learn by their interaction with these nomadic peoples? This is a subject that's still under consideration. There's been some very, very good work done in archaeology showing how these Sarmatian tribes were transformed. On the upper and lower Danube, not the middle Danube, because that's broken up by the Carpathians, the Sarmatian tribes were essentially turned into Roman allies. The Romans, just as Alexander the Great had to learn by experience, and which the Chinese Han emperors understood certainly at the start of the Han dynasty, understood that in order to patrol these frontiers, it was again a matter of controlling trade routes, access, making sure that if the nomads come onto our side of the frontier, that we regulate where they trade, how many can come in, and above all, should they want to seek lands, pastures, settlement within the Roman world, this would have to be regulated and supervised. The Romans did not try to build a Maginot Line any more than the Han emperors did, or we suspect the later Sassanid Shahs did in Transoxiana, that is, the successors to the Parthians. What they did build was a limes, a set of highways and fortified blockhouses, really, and fortresses to regulate the flow of barbarians over the frontier. We have a remarkable tombstone of the governor of the Roman province of Moesia, which approximately is sort of Bulgaria today, northern Bulgaria along the lower Danube. And this governor, Plautius Iulianus, Tiberius Plautius Iulianus, in the time of Nero, reports how he managed to break up an attack by the Roxolani, and then he took measures to secure the province thereafter. He took hostages from the barbarians north of the Danube, and he selectively settled 100,000 of these people as colonists. They would be known as coloni in the Roman legal accounts. These were Roxolani. There were some Dacians, probably some Germanic peoples. And they were scattered through the provinces to relieve the pressure that would cause these people to migrate. And this is a very, very sensible policy. It's a policy that is pursued for the next 200 years along the Roman frontiers. And it is a policy that we suspect is also very similar to the type of policies the Han emperors used. The Han emperors brought in Chinese settlements in the Ordos Triangle, on the upper reaches of the Yellow River. They came to terms with lesser tribes of the Xuan Nu. Recall that when the Xuan Nu Confederation broke in two, the southern tribes were enrolled as sort of allies of the Han emperor. They had favorable treatment. The more distant ones were outer barbarians. The Romans essentially resort to similar types of practices along the Danube and stabilize their frontier quite successfully. The other group of Sarmatians we know about are the Alans. They seem to have migrated out of the Pontic Caspian steppe region into the Kuban and the grasslands just north of the Caucasus. And the Alans still, there are people who claim descent from these Alans down to this day in what is now the Russian Republic. The Alans proved to be a common foe to both the Romans and the Parthians. Several times they broke through the so-called Dariel and Derbent passes. These are the great passes that allow the nomadic peoples to cross over the Caucasus or into the Elburz Mountains and enter either into the Middle East or into Iran. We have a number of reports of Alan attacks. A famous one in 72 AD is recorded by Josephus, where he reports that something like 10,000 or 20,000, and these are very vague terms, crossed over into the Caucasus and raided across Mesopotamia and Media and sacked cities, and it was a horrible experience, and then the invaders withdrew. The Alans are, again, the people of whom Arrian writes when he draws up that tactical manual in 135. This is obviously a group of Alans who have crossed the Caucasus and have hooked a, coming down, they'd be hooking a right turn rather than a left turn, so they run into Roman Asia Minor, and hence the tactical manual. This case, those passes become extremely important, and the Romans and Parthians come to some kind of agreement over Armenia, in part, to make sure that the routes leading over the Caucasus into Armenia are monitored and regulated by Armenians and Georgian allies as early warning signals for Alans who would be, or other nomadic peoples, later they'll be Turks, raiding into the settled zones. So what was the sum total of the experience of Rome with the Sarmatians? The Sarmatians never fuse into an effective confederacy. It is a question that is seldom posed, but I think is really central to trying to understand not only how Romans dealt with Sarmatians, but later, a more powerful nomadic threat, the Huns. The Sarmatians, well-armed, with excellent trade routes, became addicted to Roman goods and never acquired the kind of great leader like a Modu Chanyu or later an Attila the Hun who could weld the various tribes of the Pontic Caspian steppes into a confederate, into an effective confederation. This may be in part because for all of the trade goods and all of the advantages, including grape wine, which is reported a great deal, that the tribes obtained from the Romans, they never really gained much of a political sense of how to organize themselves against the Romans. The Xuan Nu came into immediate contact with the Chinese emperor. That whole tribute system of the five baits resulted in Xuan Nu kings getting Chinese brides who came with great retinues, with Xuan Nu rulers and princes, like, you know, the righteous king of the West, or the right, as he would be called, the righteous king of the left, receiving Chinese mandarins, technicians, and specialists who could actually create some kind of court, some kind of sense of a wider institutional monarchy around which you could weld the inner and outer tribes into an effective confederation. That was never available due to the contact with the Romans, in part because the Romans never dealt with barbarians the same way many other peoples did. Chinese, Parthians, even Persian kings. The Roman emperor was a military dictator who represented a republic. He was still a magistrate. And the idea of sending Roman princesses, even if the term is relevant, was impossible under Roman law. Barbarians do not marry out, Romans do not marry peregrines barbarians. And so there was never the same kind of political diplomatic exchange between Rome and the Sarmatians that allowed those Sarmatian tribes to learn the kind of political institutions and organization that other nomadic tribes did by exposure to the Chinese Empire or to the Persian Empire in the case of the Middle East. And so the tribes remained divided. In the 3rd century AD, a people from Scandinavia, the Goths, had left their home in Scandinavia. They traveled those trade routes onto the Pontic Caspian steppes. And starting from about 235 to 250 AD, the Goths, and this these are Germanic peoples from Sweden, began to raid and attack the Roman Empire. They subjected the Sarmatian peoples. They turned them into clients and allies. They learned the horse riding techniques from the Sarmatians and set up a loose confederacy on the Pontic's Caspian steppes. But the Goths, too, never managed to get the kind of political organization that they were in a position to dictate and change the Roman world the way the Xuan Nu were able to dictate terms to the Han Emperor. The Goths were driven back in the 3rd century. They were put under a Roman alliance structure, and they remain in a loose Roman alliance down till the arrival of the Huns in 375. And so, in my opinion, the Roman experience with nomadic tribes, Sarmatian tribes, led the Romans to be rather complacent and self-satisfied in dealing with them. These are relatively easy tribes to manipulate, to divide and conquer, to follow traditional Roman policies, just regulate the trade. And when a really serious threat came off the steppes in the 370s from the east, a people who had had exposure to Chinese civilization, a people who probably are a spinoff of the Xuan Nu, and came to be controlled by one of the great conquerors of the steppes, Attila, Rome was really in no position to know how to handle a great steppe confederacy. And that will result in a very, very different situation that contributes directly to the breakup of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century AD.
Lecture 9. Trade across the Tar Rim Basin.
In this lecture and the next lecture, I want to slow down a bit in dealing with various nomadic peoples from antiquity. What I wish to concentrate on in this lecture is something known as the Silk Road. It was a term coined in 1877 by a German explorer, Seidenstraße in German, and it conjures up images of the exotic, of long-distance goods being shipped from China to Rome, silks, grape wine, all of this. It's a popular image, an image that is very attractive in a number of ways, and yet at the same time, remarkably, there's a great deal of truth to this image. The term, as I said, was coined by a German traveler, a fellow by the name of Ferdinand von Richthofen, and he had traveled out to Central Asia, the cities of the Tarim Basin, actually, and in 1877 he began excavating sites in what are now essentially Chinese Turkestan, used to be known as Sinkiang, and his marvelous discoveries drew attention to this region, which you have to remember in 1877 was a pretty wild and woolly area. Very little of it was known by Europeans. Incidentally, this traveler is the uncle of the famous Manfred von Richthofen, who's the Red Baron of the First World War, just sort of an interesting aside, prominent family in Germany. More important was a British adventurer, archaeologist. If anyone has a claim to the kind of Indiana Jones legacy, it is Sir Orell Stein, who was a native of Budapest, who eventually became a naturalized British subject. And Stein carried out four expeditions running from 1900 to 1930. He made off with an enormous haul of texts, Buddhist manuscripts, coming especially from the Mogao Caves in the vicinity of the city of Dengwang, which is a largely Chinese city near the Jade Gate, the Yumen Pass, and a jump-off point on the Silk Road. The finds were fabulous. Stein's excavations revealed documents that were written in Chinese, in early Turkish languages, particular Uyghur Turkish. We'll talk about the Uyghurs later on. In Tocharian, that very unusual Indo-European language that apparently broke away from the parent language centuries earlier. Sogdian, which is an Eastern Iranian language widely spoken in the cities of Transoxiana and was a commercial language. There's all sorts of Buddhist texts, Manichae texts, texts of early Christianity, the Eastern Christianity known as Nestorian. The finds were incredibly rich. Stein has been criticized for not carrying out the kind of scientific excavations that one would do today. But nonetheless, the collection in the British Museum today owes its existence to the efforts of Stein. These documents have given us a flood of light as to the question of international trade. And in this lecture, I want to look at this legendary Silk Road and all of its trade connections, not just that connection that would run from Samarkand, more or less ancient Marakanda, across the Tarim Basin to the Jade Gate, but its extensions into China, its extensions into the steppes. There's a big spur that goes off into North India, and the extension across the Middle East that would take goods to the ports of the Mediterranean world, notably the city of Antioch in the Roman period, today Antakya in Turkey, which is the great export city. We also look at the corresponding and complementary ocean-going routes, which is something that also appears in the first century BC as part of that wider trade network. Now, the Silk Road has great romantic images to it, but it's also historically extremely important. And what I'd like to do first is sketch out a bit of the way there. That is, what were the routes used to move these goods? And then we will look at actually the goods themselves that were moved, and finally the merchants, the type of people who moved these goods, and that then what was the ramifications of what some would call the first steps to a kind of international, or if you will, global economy that emerges between the 2nd century BC and the 2nd century AD. Well, let us take our primary overland route, and let us start from the point that was really probably the most important point in the entire network, and that is Han China. I've had reasons to stress Han China in dealing with the nomadic peoples, and in terms of the Silk Road, the great capitals of the Han Empire, Luoyang and then later Chang'an in the Yellow River, those two great imperial cities are the jump-off point for trade that would move west. And what they are carrying first and foremost is Chinese silk. And the Chinese emperors come to regulate silk production. What we would call a sericulture is the fancy term for it. And silk was the main commodity that was drawing all these foreign merchants into those Han capitals. Well, you would leave those cities. You would leave the protection of the Han emperors as you move farther west, as envoys learned to their dismay on several occasions. And you'd get into what is known as the Guangxu Corridor. And that is a narrow band of land connecting the upper areas of China to the Tarim Basin. To the north are the steppes, to the south is the Great Tibetan Plateau. And there is a pass, the Yumen Pass, popularly known as the Jade Gate, through which all the trade has to pass. The Han emperors made sure that the Great Wall extended out to this point and offered protection. And furthermore, when China was strong enough, the emperor stationed garrisons in that vicinity at the Yumen Gate on the other side in Dongguang in order to tax trade and regulate the exports. From that point, you moved in one of two directions. You could move along a northern route. This route was to skirt the Taklamakan Desert. The Taklamakan Desert is essentially an alkaline desert which is almost impossible to cross except in small nomadic groups. You would move along the northern fringe of that desert among various oasis cities. These included the cities of Hami, Turfan, Yangtze, Korta, Kucha, Aksu, which means white water in Turkish. There was a southern route that followed Dongguang, Nia, Khotan, and Yarkand. Whether you went on the northern route or the southern route, and it's sort of like a circle around this great desert depression, you would end up at the city of Kashgar. That's the nexus of these two routes. From Kashgar, you crossed over the Pamir mountain range. That was a formidable barrier. It would lead you into one of three river systems. Each of these river systems would take you into different directions to the west. The northern one would descend into the river we know in the west as the Jaxartes, or as it's known by its new Turkish name, the Sir Darya. And that was a very, very important route because that would lead you down into the region of Fergana where the horses are. And from that route, you could follow on to the Aral Sea and follow the steppe routes across the Aral Sea, north of the Caspian, and you'd pop out on the ports of the Black Sea. And essentially, that route would take you from Greek cities on the Black Sea all the way to the Jaxartes River over the Pamir mountain range, ultimately to China. The middle route descends into a river that the ancients knew as the Polytametus. That would be the name that Alexander the Great would apply. Today, that is the Zevrashan River. That route, too, would lead you into Transoxiana. It would take you ultimately to the cities of Central Asia, such as Bukhara, eventually to Merv, Margiana in ancient times, and across the cities of northern Iran to the ports of the Mediterranean. The third route would lead down into the upper Oxus River. That Oxus River is now known as the Amu Darya, and in antiquity, the great city there was Bactra, the capital of Bactria. This was the center of that Greco-Bactrian kingdom, and Bactra becomes a major, it's today the modern city of Balkh, is a major jump-off point for routes going into India, especially, crossing the Khyber Pass. Foremost, the city of Samarkand was the linchpin of those two northern routes, the middle and northern route. Many routes coming over that northern or middle route ended up in Samarkand. Its predecessor was Marikanda, and from there it would go down to Merv, it would go to Bukhara, you could go to the steppes, you could go to Iran. All of these cities, Bukhara, Samarkand, Balkh, Kashgar, would have long histories on this trade route known as the Silk Road. And these cities were just as legendary as the cities of the Tarim Basin and the Jade Gate. At the same time, there was a complementary sea route that was pioneered largely by the peoples of the Mediterranean world. We get varying accounts on this, but usually it's dated around 116 to 114 BC. A fellow by the name of Eudoxus of Cyzicus is credited with understanding how to use the monsoon seasons to propel ships across the Indian Ocean, which the Romans called the Erythraean Sea. This is credited to Eudoxus. There's another fellow that's sometimes credited, Hippalus, and the usual thought is that Hippalus was the actual skipper of the ship. And we got two contradictory reports, one coming out of Strabo and one coming out of this document known as the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. Whoever is actually responsible, by the opening of the first century BC, there was a regular sea communication from Egypt, which was controlled by the Greek dynasty, the Ptolemies, down the Red Sea, across the Indian Ocean, to the ports on the western shores of India. This trade route is complementary. It did not displace the Silk Road. Far from it, it was in a way a spur or an extension of the Silk Road. For two reasons. Once Rome secured the Mediterranean world, and that was clear by 31 BC, where the Mediterranean world was consolidated by the Emperor Augustus, the Roman court, the city of Rome, its senators, the imperial court, the wealthy provincial cities of the Mediterranean world had an appetite for Chinese silks and Indian spices, also gems coming from Indian mines. And that meant an enormous amount of trade went down the Red Sea to ports on the Red Sea, particularly the port of Berenice, which has been excavated, which is on the shores of the Red Sea in Roman Egypt. It would leave in mid-July, go down to what the Romans called Arabia Felix, today Yemen, and then make their way over to the Indian ports. We have a very good navigational manual written from the first century AD that describes this. We know the ports, the distances, the locations, and one of the most important ports was Musiris, which is more or less in the vicinity of Cochin. It was in the pepper areas, the Romans are very familiar with Sri Lanka, and above all, what they wanted in landing in the Indian ports were Chinese silks, which were coming overland from Balkh, from Bactra, brought in by the Silk Road. And so in the ancient and medieval world, there's always this ocean-going extension of the Silk Road, but it never displaces. It's not in competition. It's really complementary. And the displacement of the Silk Road by oceanic routes is really a phenomenon that occurs in the 16th and 17th centuries and changes the whole dynamics of steppe peoples and steppe empires, and that will come later in the course. Besides these trade routes, we want to know a bit of how do you get the goods from one place to the other. This is an arduous task. You have to travel overland. Well, there are various ways to do it. One is by wheeled vehicles, another is pack animals. But one of the great breakthroughs by the 2nd century BC is the extensive use of camels. Camels were domesticated both in Arabia, and that would be the dromedary, the one-humped camel, and the Bactrian, the two-humped camel in Central Asia, which is more resistant to the cold. Later on, Muslims from the 9th to 11th century would breed a kind of hybrid, which would wipe out the Bactrian camel in its homeland and bring in this one-humped hybrid, which is stronger and better adapted to the cold. Camels offered several advantages. First, they could go a lot farther and longer than horses, mules, and donkeys. Furthermore, by using packs of camels, you would increase carrying capacity by at least 50%. Camels are thought to carry 300 pounds, whereas a good mule maybe 200 pounds. They did not have to be shod. You didn't have the problem of breakdown with wheeled vehicles if you went to pack animals. And above all, camels conserve food and water in their systems, and they're extremely efficient animals. They live much longer than donkeys and other types of draft animals. And so the use of camels, which had spread starting in the 6th century BC with Aramaic-speaking peoples in the Fertile Crescent across Central Asia, and eventually camels will reach China. They become the prime beast of burden, and that makes possible the trade on the Silk Road. In addition, you have to keep in mind that caravans varied. They weren't all extensive, long-distance caravans. We do know of great caravans. They could comprise of 600 or 1,000 camels traveling with hundreds of merchants, with a military detachment, usually nomads who've been hired to protect it. Along would travel all sorts of entertainment groups. There would be lesser merchants. This was virtually a mini-moving city. And we have such reports of these types of caravans leaving Chinese cities, arriving in Samarkand, particularly from the medieval period. Kashgar was home to many of these great caravans because that's the linchpin where everything's coming out of the Tarim Basin and is ready to move out. And so these caravans would travel 1,000 miles in order to get to the destination. And they wouldn't travel it all at once. Calculation is, on an average speed, a caravan could cover 1,000 miles in 40 days. Very few caravans ever did that. Caravans would stop. They would have rest periods. They would take on new goods. They would trade. Caravans could take really half a year to get from the jump-off point to the final destination. In addition, there were lots of lesser trade